The reporter assigned to survey Cleveland as part of a study of American cities titled his report, Cleveland, the City Where Nothing Ever Happened. With some misgiving, the editor allowed the report to be published under that title. He expected to be deluged with indignant letters. He received not a one. Apparently, we Clevelanders are quite satisfied that our city, like one of Johnny Appleseed's famous trees, just grew. And yet, if we look carefully at our past, and if we are of that quality of mind which prefers the saga of nobility of spirit to that of physical brawn, we quickly discover that Cleveland has a history. Quite a few very fine things did indeed happen in our city. Way back when there were less than 2,000 settlers squatting along the banks of the crooked river, the Cuyahoga, Cleveland was the first community in the Western Reserve to tax for the schooling of the children of the needy. And when some of the fat cows of the day protested that their hard-earned profits should be used for such a purpose, the dissident ministers of the community got up in their pulpits and called a sin and parsimony, parsimony. And schooling has become part of the wharf and woof, the strength of Cleveland life ever since. We were one of the first communities to push energetically, not only for universal education, but for quality in education. Indeed, it was through the careful maneuvering of our legislators in Columbus in the 1820s that the first enabling act for statewide public education was passed by a simple expedient. The Cleveland legislators said, unless it is passed, we who collect the tolls at the northern end of the Ohio Canal will simply not pass these tolls back to Columbus. And the bill was passed. Later on, and early, Cleveland spoke its mind on the issue of political equality. This entire northern part of Ohio, the Western Reserve, was a hotbed of abolitionist sentiment. We were the northern terminus of the Underground Railway. Our cellars hid the escaped slave. Our boats and our sailors ferried them across to the free soil of Canada. And when a John Brown came to Cleveland with a booty already on his head, he was able to trade his horses for much needed cash. When later he was caught, he appealed to Cleveland, to a Cleveland lawyer, to conduct his defense. Cleveland spoke with one mind, that all men were equal, all men were to be free. We were the first major northern city to send a colored legislator to our state legislation 75 years ago. And men of all colors and of all creeds have been elected to local and statewide audience from our community. Never have the hate mongers, from the early days of the Klan to the Smiths and the Pelleys and the Coghlans of later times, to the extremists of our own day, been able to command in Cleveland any kind of impressive support. We can be proud of this page in our history. And we can be proud of the golden page of our history, which records honesty in government, reform and dignity. The last decades of the 19th century and the first decade of the 20th have been called by historians the nadir of our national disgrace. These were the decades in which every business had its hand in the public till, in which railroads were gobbling up public land, in which the traction companies were literally taking up the streets of a community, in which votes could be bought, councilmen could be bought, legislation could be bought, indeed the state houses themselves could be bought. Lincoln Steffens, in the year 1904, a crusading editor, published a realistic and accurate account of city government in that decade, which he called The Shame of Our Cities. And Cleveland was the shining exception. He spoke of Cleveland as the best governed city in America. Perhaps, he said, the only well-governed city. We had, as in the mayor's office, a reformed robber baron, Tom Johnson, whose simple creed was this: I know that the utility companies, he said, are a bunch of thieves and robbers. It's simple enough. I was one of them once. And he set out to protect the public welfare against the greed of the few. He ordered an investigation of the tax duplicate. And he was able to show how privilege begets privilege and how the poor were made to pay far more than the rich. He saved our lakefront from the railroads. He saved our streets from the traction companies. He established a municipal light plant who produced light and power in competition with the private monopolies and which was able to show how doctored were the figures of these private companies on which their rate demands were based. He brought in experts in the various fields of city administration. He began to do away with the spoils system by imposing civil service. He set in motion in Cleveland a tradition of reform, of government of the people and for the people, which has been the norm ever since. I do not mean by this that all our politicians have been saints. Some have been caught with their hands in the till. By and large, our government has been honest. It has been dedicated to the public welfare. It has been forthright in its statesmen to the citizenry. And by and large, the citizenry has responded by electing to office men of whatever party or persuasion who are dedicated to the public welfare. Oh yes, Cleveland has a history. It has a history of free speech, of public rostrums on the public square which anyone can mount and speak his piece, of civic forums which deliberately set out to present both sides of unpopular issues when the controlled press of our city spoke with a controlled voice. Cleveland has a history. A history of ministers and college professors, of lawyers and civic leaders and of social workers who combined with labor, with the worker, to win for labor in the early days their just place in the economic sun. Cleveland has a history of mayors who ordered employers to drive out of town the Pinkertons that they had hired to break the strikes. Cleveland has a history, and we can be proud of that history. But strangely and unfortunately, I have the feeling that we would like to forget the past, and we like and are indeed walking out on our history. Cleveland today is not the Cleveland of 30 or 40 years ago. We have a noble past, but let's look honestly, forthrightly, at our present. The first glorious page of Cleveland's history was a dedication to education. The education of all, quality. Now today in Cleveland, there is still good education to be had, thanks to the sacrificial integrity of a noble profession. But I ask myself, where are the graduates of our Cleveland schools of 25 years ago? And by and large, they have turned their backs on their alma maters, gone out, and founded their own schools, less crowded, less colorful. And where do we see these graduates? How do we prove their loyalty? We find them where? Financing campaigns to prevent the passage of school levies. grumbling under their breath about taxation without representation, about the high cost of owning property in the city from which they have fled. And we have, because of this turning away loyalties, interest, this failure to repay a debt of love and of obligation, an anachronistic situation which ought never to be. In our center city, we have the deprived, economically, culturally, deprived of love, deprived of home, deprived often of bare subsistence. In our center city, the schools themselves must do the major task of social reconstruction. And we tie their hands, 40 plus children in a class. And in our affluent suburbs, 21, 2. More money in the suburbs than in the city. More need in the city than in the suburbs. And we, the graduates of the city schools, are in the suburbs. And we grumble when the obvious is presented to us, that some new method of taxation, some more equitable method of financing our schools must be devised, that social need can be met, and that those that are growing in the city itself will not be for all of their lives crippled by an education that is not equal to the terrific challenges of the day. And what is true of education is true of every other facet of our history. We once prided ourselves in our concern for the less fortunate, for the new immigrant, for those of other colors and of other skins. But I ask you to read our papers of these days. I ask you to read of the tragic football which has been made of our welfare program. We insist on what? That artificially drawn municipal lines determine who shall pay the cost of welfare. And what do these lines entail? That the poor must pay poor relief. That the wealthy escape that burden. That they can concentrate on the frills, the recreational activities, the leisure time costs. And so we have the tragic anachronism in our city. The tragic anachronism of a program of joint welfare being broken in two because the city suffering, reeling under four recessions in four years, cannot pay its share. The wealthy retreating, being anything but generous, promising nothing beyond their widow's might, and the less fortunate, the have-nots, unable to meet the cost, and the oppressed, those lacking, promised what? That on a cold January 1, 1963, they may have one fast in every five meals, 60% only of the basic subsistence allotment available, prescribed by the state. This in a city, next to the richest suburb in the nation and probably in the world. Poverty amidst abundance. A class situation such as never has existed before in our city. Why? Because you and I, and all those who are like us, all those who are fortunate as we are fortunate, have for all too many years now turned away from responsibility, built for ourselves isolated, hermetically sealed suburbs, deluded ourselves that we can somehow live off the city, live near the city, take advantage of its cultural activities, but bear no responsibility whatsoever for the problems of urban living, for the tensions of urban living, for the slum conditions incident on urban life, for the poverty of the new worker, for the illiteracy which is being brought to us from the south and the border states. We are at fault. We and our prejudices and our smugness. We who have turned away from responsibility. We who have turned away from a proud history. We who have allowed petty lines on a petty map to say that there is not one city, but 40 in Cuyahoga. Not one community, but many separate communities. That Cleveland's problems are no longer our own. Oh, there are, unfortunately, two cities. In the center city, 99% of those whose incomes is in the lowest 10th percentile of our economy live. In the center city, 50% of the dwellings are over 40 years of age. In the center city, over 90% of those on relief live. In the suburbs, there is wealth. In the suburbs, there is opportunity. In the suburbs, there is affluence. In the suburbs, there is abundance. In the suburbs, there is a blindness. A blindness to responsibility, for which all of us must share the blame. I have in my possession a document written 40 years ago last month by the Chamber of Commerce. It's called Political Consolidation, Cleveland's Most Pressing Need. It was written on the occasion of a proposal to annex Lakewood and West Park to the city proper. I'd like to read to you two paragraphs of it. As the commercial development of Cleveland grows, more and more of its citizens are compelled to seek homes in its suburbs with a resulting effect on the standard of the citizenship of the city. A constantly increasing number of those whose daily work and business is in the larger city and whose welfare and prosperity is materially affected by the city conditions find themselves denied a voice in determining its politics or selecting its government. Everyone who lives, works, or who has his business within the metropolitan district should be concerned by its social welfare and commercial prosperity. To legally deny himself the right of a voice in the government of the larger unit is a shirking of his responsibility. The political unity of the entire metropolitan community is essential to the development of its commerce, its industry, and its social activity. We are of the opinion that the artificial boundaries existing between Lakewood, West Park, and Cleveland now serve no good purpose, and that where there were doubtless at one time many good reasons why these three communities should be separate administrative units, the rapid growth of the entire metropolitan area in the last decade has removed these reasons. And now the community should become one politically, as they are now one in fact. We therefore recommend to the voters of West Park, Lakewood, and Cleveland that they vote yes on the annexation proposals, which will appear on the ballot at the next general election, November 7. The voters voted no. As they have voted no on every annexation, every metropolitan government proposal of the last 40 years. And I ask myself why. Is it that they do not know the facts? The anachronism of volunteer fire departments in the metropolitan area in the 20th century. Of three-man police forces, of a cultural center which must be inundated every time there is a minor flood in the area because the outlying suburbs cannot agree on any sewer proposals. The lack of zoning restrictions uniform in a given area. Is it that they lack knowledge of the facts? 6-7 years ago, the Metropolitan Commission spent $500,000 organizing the facts, publishing the facts, making known the obvious. And their proposals were voted down. Is it that a metropolitan form of government, some new tax structure, some new political structure which would bind us at one, is more costly? Hardly. It costs far more to begin a recreational program, a service program, a sewage program, an educational program de novo, from scratch, than it does to enlarge an already well-defined system. It has cost us far more to set up local governments than it would have been to extend the civic government. What then is the reason? The reason is in here, in our psychology, in our fears, in our attempts, pathetic though they be, to immunize and isolate ourselves from the social roiling tensions of the city, from cowardice, a desire to flee, to be excused from, to build walls against. Against what? Suffering humanity? Need? But we have escaped, and we have turned our backs, and we have fled, and it must be in our conscience. And no amount of monies given later in welfare, patronizingly, excuse us of this original, elemental, and basic fault in our civic character. For 40 years, the obvious has been known. For 40 years, we, Clevelanders, have refused to accept elemental right and elemental need. Cleveland, 1962, is a beggar city. Cleveland, 1962, is a pauper, pathetically with its hand out. 95% of the money spent on our highway construction in the city have come from federal and state funds. 53% of the monies that we could gather together from welfare have come from other purses but our own. 60% of the money spent for slum clearance and housing redevelopment have come from outside the city. Cleveland, 1962, is a city moving into the future with baby steps. The future is passing us by. Only in Cleveland do we have an inner belt which goes halfway around the city. Only in Cleveland do we have a West Side Rapid which goes halfway to the airport. Only in Cleveland have we raised land for new low-cost housing and been unable to raise housing on more than half of that land. Only in Cleveland do we build for the future a convention center which can hardly raise its eyes above the ground. Only in Cleveland do we have a major downtown renewal which is as yet headline after 5 years on the drawing board. And it is not the fault of the city. It is not the fault of a dishonest administration. It is not blind obstinacy on the part of those who have been in control of government. They have been willing. It is the fault of a city which has fractionalized, separated out, divided its interests. It is the fault of a city where the press, where business, the men of public life are not of one mind and of one heart. The men of business have improved the welfare conditions of our city, but they have avoided politics. They've avoided being in and of the center, the heart. The men of politics have little access to the men of business. And the press plays up the drama of the interplay between the two. And so Cleveland has been a city of divided councils, of halfway measures, of a mincing approach to the future. One by one, the other communities have passed us by, gone beyond, built buildings where we have vacant parking lots, established the fundamentals of the future, but we still argue where the future is to be located. Cleveland, my friends, cannot remain a great city unless it soon takes stock of itself, unless we now, take stock of ourselves. Cleveland cannot have greatness if there are to be two Clevelands. Cleveland cannot be a great city if it is to be a split-level city, some with our heads high in the air and some with our feet deep in the gutter. Either we are one, and we admit the serious problems which must be faced, and we face them, or we are nothing. Because those of us who seek to escape will find that there is no escape. Delinquency cannot be kept in the central wards. Lack of economic progress will affect us in our pocketbooks, in our business. Ultimately, the tax rate must go up, and unless it brings, as it goes up, new improvements, new attractions for new business, we will pay the lion's share. Economically, socially, morally, every indication points to one single fact, that we must turn our eyes to the center, join with them, admit our common problems, and solve them. Now, the tragedy of all of this in Cleveland is that it's very hard to get angry with our fellow Clevelanders. Cleveland is a good city of good people. The average Clevelander has involved himself deeply in the welfare programs of our cities. He has worked hard. He has some accomplishment to point to. He can be proud of this great university circle complex which spreads out about us. There is nothing like it in our country. But I ask myself, is this of the suburb or of the city? And I remind myself always that less than 0.5% of the graduates of our city schools will be enrolled next year at our cultural center universities. I remind myself that so much of what takes place here meets the cultural needs of the Heights, not of the Depths. It has been designed for the haves rather than for the have-nots. But it is a first step, grand, fine, promising, but it is only the first step. Cleveland stands at the threshold of a new era. Cleveland can take a toboggan slide into nothingness. We have no assurance that the future is ours. Cleveland can move, as it has in the past, from strength to strength. But Cleveland will progress only as we recapture the force of our history, the sense of moral virtue, of civic passion, of human sympathy, of insistence on human dignity, which has been elemental, which must be elemental, which I am confident will be elemental.